1972, Joey Gallo killed in Little Italy during dinner at Umberto's Clam House.
An hour from now, be it tonight, or 100 years from now, I'm in jail. I mean,
they get there by violence, and often as not, they leave by violence.
Between $3 and $5 million in cash and valuables was taken from the Lufthansa cargo terminal out at Kennedy Airport.
I can give you guys $500,000 a year without a problem.
New York City is a war zone for mobsters and their targets.
Hello everyone, and welcome into episode 53 of The Black Hand, an organized crime history podcast. I'm your host, Bliss Grieve, and on today's show, we're going to be talking about the complete true story behind The Wire. One of the greatest TV shows of all time, let alone in the crime genre. We'll be covering the real-life inspiration behind not only the show's famed drug dealers, but also those of the police, the politicians, and one very famous stick-up boy. More than that, we'll also talk about how the show came to be in the first place, and the general themes that it explored throughout its time on the air. Before we get started, if you want to support the show, please rate it and go follow the show's Instagram and Twitter pages at The Black Hand Pod, and please feel free to reach out. Also, consider giving a little bit to the show's Venmo at The Black Hand Pod as well. The link's in the description. But without further ado, let's get right into today's episode. For those of you who don't know, The Wire is an American crime drama TV series created and primarily written by author and former police reporter David Simon. The series premiered on June 2nd, 2002, and ended on March 9th, 2008, comprising 60 episodes over 5 seasons. Set and produced in Baltimore, Maryland, The Wire introduces a different institution of the city and its relationship to law enforcement in each season, while retaining characters and advancing storylines from previous seasons. The 5 subjects covered in the show are, in chronological order, the illegal drug trade, the port system, the city government and bureaucracy, education and schools, and the print news medium. The series is praised for its literary themes, its uncommonly accurate exploration of society and politics, and its realistic portrayal of urban life. During its original run, the series only received average ratings and never won any television awards, but is now often cited as one of the greatest shows in the history of television. And you'll notice how I didn't say organized crime show, because it was so much more than that, because it transcended genre categories, seamlessly melding ostensibly separated concepts, and has captivated the minds of people interested not only in organized crime, but in society in general. And in my opinion, so much of the appeal and fascination that surrounds The Wire is intrinsically linked to the sheer realism of not only the story being told, but also the setting in which it takes place. It perfectly encapsulates the drug world of the late 20th and early 21st centuries, while showing how surrounding factors like political corruption, police stat padding, and neglect of the homeless influence the evolution of the streets as much, if not more, than the very people who ran them. The show is also able to, more so than any that I've seen, accurately tackle the concept and importance of the rise and fall of pagers heading into the rise of prepaid cell phones in the drug game, the importance of which cannot be overstated. And overall, The Wire was a study of street life as a whole and from all perspectives, what it was like to be a drug dealer at all levels, from a simple corner boy or lookout, to a lieutenant, to a full-blown boss. But more than that, unlike any other show of its nature, it also showed you the perspectives of everyone else as well. Whether it was that of the police, politicians, the homeless, journalists, or even the community affected, and the children who are forced to live in them. And much of this came as a result of the experiences of those who created the show, specifically Edward Burns and David Simon. So I figured we'd start today's episode by talking about their respective backgrounds and how they culminated in the show being made in the first place. And we'll start with Ed Burns, because it was his experiences that largely shaped the show. Born on January 29th, 1946, Ed Burns served as infantry in the Vietnam War before joining the Baltimore Police Department, where he'd work for the next 20 years. When he worked in homicide, his partner was Detective Harry Edgerton, who would later become the basis for the character Frank Pembleton on the TV series Homicide: Life on the Street. Following his retirement from the police force, Burns became a teacher in the Baltimore public school system. He has since said that he stumbled into teaching with little preparation because of the intense demand for teachers in inner city schools. He taught 7th and 8th grade, and psychologically, he compared the experience of teaching to the Vietnam War. He found the experience profoundly challenging because of the emotional damage that the vast majority of his students had already experienced before ever reaching his classroom. He saw his primary role as instilling caring behavior in his students, and felt that his major impact was in giving the children an example of, quote, an adult who's consistent, who's always there, who always comes through with what he said. Then, that's a new world for them. But by 1997, he co-authored, with David Simon, The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner-City Neighborhood, the true account of a West Baltimore community dominated by a heavy drug market. It was named Notable Book of the Year by the New York Times, and an adaptation of the book, also called The Corner, was produced as a 6-hour TV miniseries for HBO, which received 3 Emmy Awards. And his next big project would be The Wire. Which makes this the perfect time to switch over to the background of David Simon, the man who would complete the duo behind the show. David Simon was born on February 9, 1960, in Washington, D.C., and graduated from BCC High School in Bethesda, Maryland, where he wrote for the school newspaper. In 1983, he graduated from the University of Maryland, and during his tenure there, he wrote and was the editor for an independent student newspaper called The Diamondback, and became friends with fellow journalist David Mills. After leaving college, Simon worked as a police reporter at the Baltimore Sun from 1982 to 95, spending most of his career covering the crime beat. But by 1987, Simon was a union captain when the writing staff went on strike in 1987 over benefit cuts. So in 1988, disillusioned, Simon took a year to go into the Baltimore Police Department Homicide Unit to write a book. And his leave of absence from the Sun resulted in his first book, Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, based on his experiences shadowing the Baltimore Police Department Homicide Unit during 1988. The book won the 1992 Edgar Award for Best Fact Crime Book, while the Associated Press called it, quote, a true crime classic. The Library Journal also highly recommended it, and Newsday described it as, quote, one of the most engrossing police procedural mystery books ever written. And the book eventually became an award-winning TV series by the same name, and Simon worked on it as a writer and producer, eventually winning the Austin Film Festival's Outstanding TV Writer Award in 2010. And as a result of his newfound success, Simon left his job with the Baltimore Sun in 1995 to work on Homicide, during the production of the show's 4th season. And by 1997, he co-authored, with Ed Burns, The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner-City Neighborhood. Afterwards, he once again returned to his journalism career, but felt further changed by his experiences. And soon after Homicide concluded, Simon co-wrote and produced The Corner as a six-hour TV miniseries for HBO. And it was really around this time, with Simon and Burns both acclaimed true crime writers, that the image for The Wire really started to come into view. They originally set out to create a police drama loosely based on Burns' experiences working on protracted investigations of violent drug dealers using surveillance technology. But during this time, Burns faced frustration with the bureaucracy of the police department, which he equated with his own ordeals as a police reporter for the Baltimore Sun, resulting in the show becoming, quote, more of a treatise about institutions and individuals than a straight cop show. And David Simon chose to set The Wire in Baltimore due to his familiarity with the city. So with the concept in mind, the pair just had to find a network willing to host their show. But during his time as a writer and producer for the NBC program, Homicide, based on his book by the same title, also set in Baltimore, Simon came into conflict with NBC network executives who were displeased by the show's perceived pessimism. So we wanted to avoid a repeat of these conflicts and decided to take The Wire to HBO because of their working relationship from the miniseries, The Corner. HBO was initially doubtful about including a police drama in its lineup, but agreed to produce the pilot episode, and the rest is history. So now that you know how the show came to be, we can get into its evolution and the basis for many of its characters. And I figured the best way to do it would be by season, so season 1 is up first. The first season of The Wire, comprised of 13 episodes, which aired on June 2nd, 2002, focused on the theme of the illegal drug trade, but also that of chain of command. This is reflected not only in the bureaucratic nature of the Baltimore Police Department and the obsession of some officers to make rank, but also the dealers, who are constantly reminded of the rules of the street by their peers as soon as they break those rules. Season 1 also introduced the viewer to two major groups of characters, the Baltimore Police Department and a drug dealing organization run by the Barksdale family. As a homicide detective named Jimmy McNulty served as the main focal point for the BPD and D'Angelo Barksdale for the Barksdale organization. And after the BPD has little success with street level arrests or with securing informants, a unit was formed entirely dedicated to taking down the Barksdale crew, with Lieutenant Cedric Daniels at its head and including major characters like McNulty, Kima Griggs, Lester Freeman, Ellis Carver, and Herc. And the investigation eventually secured dialed number records, Title III wiretaps, and pager clones to monitor the Barksdale organization, leading the investigation to areas the commanding officers had hoped to avoid, including political corruption. And the real-life experiences implanted in the show really come out right at the start. Because in the very first scene of The Wire, Jimmy McNulty, as a homicide detective, shows up to the murder scene of a man named Omar Isaiah Betts, nicknamed Snot Boogie, who was killed for stealing the pot from a local craps game. And oddly enough, this story is actually true, and David Simon had heard it, down to the line about America, from a police detective, and it also appears in Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets. And elements of the character of Jimmy McNulty himself are also drawn from real life, as he's loosely based on Ed Burns, which is a great segue to talk about the inspiration behind some of the characters who became part of the major crimes unit, though there's only a few. But the biggest of which is probably Lester Freeman, one of my personal favorite characters. And while it's unofficial, it's likely that the character is based on a former detective for the Baltimore Police Department named Harry Edgerton. He's notable for his work in the department's homicide unit and on the investigation of a drug dealer named Melvin Williams, which Ed Burns also worked on, making him the most likely candidate in my opinion. Another character from the unit based on real life is Roland Przybylowski, the cowboy cop turned good police turned school teacher who is also based on Ed Burns himself. Prez's skill with cracking codes in the Barksdale investigation parallel Burns's investigation of Melvin Williams. And his experiences as a public school teacher are modeled on those of Burns, who became an educator after leaving the force. Lastly, while he obviously wasn't a real part of the unit, the addict Bubbles played a real role in getting the unit some of their earliest important intel. And he was based on a real-world police informant who went by the nickname Possum. David Simon met Possum twice before the man died of AIDS, and at his family's request, his true identity remains a secret. He was known for having a good memory and for helping cops identify players in the drug game, traits that would come to define Bubbles from the beginning. So with the inspiration behind the major crime unit wrapped up, I figured we'd talk about the only other major police characters drawn from real life in Jay Landsman and Bunk Moreland. Jay Landsman was based on and named after a homicide sergeant that David Simon met while writing Homicide, and the character was often given dialogue that the writers recall the real Landsman using. And funny enough, the real Jay Landsman ended up playing Lieutenant Dennis Mello on the show in seasons 3 through 5, who ended up taking over for Bunny Colvin. While Bunk Moreland was based on another BPD detective named Oscar Rick Wrecker, also nicknamed Bunk, who was working under Sergeant Jay Landsman when David Simon was researching for Homicide. And it was his demeanor and handle that would form the basis for Bunk, another fan favorite. And in another nod to the real man, the series even featured a cop named Oscar Wrecker in its final season. But with the police wrapped up, we can really get into the main event of today's episode, which is of course the drug dealers, specifically a lot of the ones that were introduced in the first season. The most important of which is of course Avon Barksdale, who is based on the lives of two real-world heavyweight drug dealers. The first of which is a former Baltimore heavyweight named Melvin Williams, who tried to dip his feet in the drug game in the 1960s, but ended up just being sent to prison. It was when he got out of prison that he got back in touch with his mentor and local Jewish crime boss, Julius Salisbury, who connected Williams with people in New York and the Five Families. Afterwards, he went to a location that Salisbury told him to be, where people showed him vials of drugs, and they made an arrangement for a shipment of drugs to show up on another side of Baltimore, officially starting Melvin's run as one of the most storied drug dealers in Baltimore's history. And with the help of multiple organized crime elements, Williams received the backing of street muscle, police officials, and some even say politicians and judges alike, who were covertly complicit to Melvin's ability to reach such success of selling 40 to 50 kilos of heroin in Baltimore on a monthly basis. And it was the city's black business district that ran along West Baltimore's famed Pennsylvania Avenue that became ground zero for drug enterprises and proved to be incredibly lucrative for Melvin. Then, as new laws like the Fair Housing Act became the norm, white flight from the inner city also became prevalent, and drug dealers who worked for Williams moved in and set up shop. And the open-air drug markets that came about on that side of town created a devastating impact on the social, economic, and educational dynamics of the local black community. At the same time, the heroin became a popular and acceptable form of recreational drug use in Baltimore. Those in charge of the city's commercial growth started to implement the development of high-rise public housing, which probably sounds familiar, giving birth to the storied Murphy Homes and Lexington Terrace housing projects. But the lack of economic opportunity made many of these communities extremely vulnerable to drug solicitation, which Melvin gladly took advantage of. Eventually becoming Baltimore's main supplier of heroin, and at its peak, his operations employed 200 dealers and made millions of dollars a year. He also owned dozens of properties and vehicles, while his gang waged a campaign of violence and intimidation throughout the city. Sometime in the early to mid-70s, Williams was caught up on drug charges and sentenced to 15 years in prison. But he was paroled in 1979 after serving just 5 years and came back to an organization that was stronger than ever, developing a cautious system that confused law enforcement. Deciding only to communicate with phone booths and pagers, which is what the members of the Barksdale organization used to communicate as well. However, on December 6th, 1984, Williams was arrested once again, this time on cocaine trafficking charges, for which he eventually received 34 years in prison. And he served just 12 years before being paroled in 1996, reforming, and becoming somewhat of a community leader. And ironically enough, Melvin Williams would end up playing the character of the Deacon in The Wire. The other real-life figure that Avon Barksdale is based on is a former heavyweight West Baltimore drug dealer named Nathan Barksdale, who also went by the nickname Bodie, which the character named Preston Broaddus would share in the show, along with other elements. He rose to power in the 1980s, dealing heroin out of the Murphy homes in West Baltimore, and serving many of the city's high-rise public housing projects. His operation was notoriously violent, likely resulting in him being shot over 20 times, which caused doctors to amputate his right leg below the knee. In 1982, he was acquitted of killing a fellow drug trafficker named Frank Harper, who was actually his mentor in the game. But in 1985, Barksdale was convicted of torturing 3 people and was sentenced to 15 years in prison. However, upon his release from prison, he attempted to reform and even joined a community service group. But by the mid-2010s, he was caught up in a DEA wiretap investigation into the Black Gorilla Family prison gang. Eventually pleading guilty for his role in a heroin conspiracy linked to the case, Barksdale was sentenced to about 4 years in federal prison, where he would end up dying. The story behind Avon's right-hand man, named Stringer Bell, is a little more complicated though, as he's a composite of 3 Baltimore drug dealers. He gets his name from 2, named Stringer Reed and Roland Bell, a pair of West Side Baltimore players. And as a fun fact, the character Ronnie Moe in The Wire also got his name from Roland Bell, who went by the nickname. While Stringer gets a lot of his personality from another man named Kenneth A. Jackson, who was born in 1957 and raised in the Latrobe homes in East Baltimore, and he really hopped in the streets early. By the time he was 17, Jackson committed his first murder when he killed a Baltimore businessman during a robbery. But with drug and gang influence, he was able to secure a high-profile lawyer and gain an acquittal on a technicality. Somewhat reminiscent of how Morris Levy got D'Angelo Barksdale off for the murder of William Gant, which was also committed during an attempted robbery. And when Jackson hit the streets again, he became a trusted associate of local heavyweight Melvin Williams. He's even believed to have been responsible for initiating a drug war in 1981, for control of the Lafayette Court housing project. Despite that, by 1984, Jackson was a player in the local scene in his own right, and even owned a mini market, a shoe store, a produce stand, rental properties in West Baltimore, similar to Stringer's web-like business portfolio, and even a club called the El Dorado Lounge in East Baltimore, which may have been the basis for Orlando's nightclub in the show, which Stringer Bell owned. Another connection the club might have to the show actually comes in season 5, when the show's fictional Baltimore Sun reports on the sale of a strip club property owned by a drug dealer in the show named Fat Face Rick. The fictional city council president, named Nerisse Campbell, is shown angrily reading a critical newspaper article about her role in the sale. An anecdote that appears to allude to real-world Baltimore mayor Sheila Dixon's part in the sale of the El Dorado Lounge. Another connection that Jackson has to the show comes in season 1, when Jimmy McNulty follows Stringer Bell to his business class at a local community college. According to Kenneth himself, Baltimore police actually were present when he took classes at Baltimore Community College. And like Jackson, Stringer Bell strives to become part of the legitimate business world and even gets involved in bribing politicians. Another member of the Barksdale group that's based on real life is the fish-loving enforcer Wee Bay Bryce, who's based on a former Baltimore contract killer named Vernon Collins, who went by Bay Brother. Among the variety of high-profile heroin dealers of the 1980s that Ed Burns investigated personally during his time in the BPD was a man named Thomas Taylor, who was partnered with none other than Collins, who he got most of his work from. Before Vernon was caught in 1987 and sentenced to 35 years in prison. Even the Barksdale's opposite on the streets, Proposition Joe, is based on an actual dealer named Joseph Johnson, who ran a ton of the city's black rackets and was eventually gunned down in a Baltimore nightclub in 1984. But now that you know the stories behind the major drug dealers in season 1, we can talk about a character that becomes as, and possibly even more important than them. I'm of course talking about Omar Little, who's regarded by most as their favorite character. And he, like Stringer Bell and Avon Barksdale, is a composite of multiple real-world figures from Baltimore. However, the one that makes up most of Omar's core elements is a former Baltimore stick-up boy named Donnie Andrews. He was born Larry Donnell Andrews in 1954 and came up in the city's West Side Projects. And it didn't take him long to hit the streets, being busted for the first time at 16, starting a path toward 18 more arrests for various misdemeanors and felonies. But he would of course become most famous for his exploits as a stick-up boy in the 1970s to the mid-80s. Robbing drug dealers, likely even robbing people connected to some of the very same dealers we've talked about today. Andrews, like Omar, had a code of ethics for the game that included not involving women or children. And it was likely during one of these robberies that one of the most infamous scenes of the show would play out in real life. The scene where Omar is ambushed by Chris Partlow, Snoop, and Michael, and only escapes by jumping out of the fourth-story window. And Andrews remains adamant that this story is true, except for just one detail. Donnie insists that he actually jumped from a higher floor, saying, quote, "This really happened to me, but I had to jump out of the sixth floor. It was either lead poisoning or take my chances. So I took my chances. I did it without thinking. If I had thought about it, I might have taken the lead poisoning." But by the 1980s, a heroin addiction started clouding his judgment, and before long, he graduated from robbery to murder for hire. When a local drug kingpin named Warren Broadley would recruit both Donnie and a former heavyweight boxer named Reggie Gross, who even fought Mike Tyson, for a job. The price was $5,000 and 2 ounces of heroin. At the time, Warren Broadley's gang violently ran the Lexington Terrence Poe homes and viewed Zachary Roach and Rodney Young as rivals, so he sent Donnie and Gross after them. After Gross killed one man, he and Andrews used MAC-11 machine pistols to kill Roach and Young in what became known as the Gold Street Murders. And the subsequent murder investigation was spearheaded by then Baltimore detective Ed Burns, who was eventually able to get a remorseful Donnie to cop to the double murder while also agreeing to wear a recording device to unlock important information about the Baltimore drug trade. In exchange, he thought he'd receive a 10-year sentence as opposed to the 2 consecutive life terms and 1 concurrent life sentences that his co-conspirator, Reggie Gross, received. But despite Donnie's cooperation with every facet of the agreement, the district attorney reneged on providing a lighter sentence, and he received life in prison. Once inside, Donnie got clean and turned his life around, eventually appearing in The Wire. He's part of the crew that Butchie sent for Omar in prison, and is killed in the very scene he inspired, where Omar jumps out of the window. Omar also received elements from other local stick-up boys that Burns came into contact with, like Shorty Boyd, Ferdinand Harvin, Billy Outlaw, and Anthony Harvey, a quartet of stick-up artists that worked the Baltimore area from the 1980s to the early 2000s. But the final element from season 1 that I want to talk about is the real-life inspiration behind the pager code that the Barksdale crew used. If you remember, on episode 5 of season 1, titled The Pager, Judge Phelan signs the wiretap affidavit for a clone on D'Angelo Barksdale's pager. And Lester Freeman finds that each pager message consists of a 7-digit phone number and a 2-digit identifying tag. But of course, when they try the phone numbers, they don't work, and Freeman eventually deduces that the Barksdale crew is using a code to mask the numbers. And it's ultimately Presbuluski that ends up cracking the code, which basically amounts to jumping the 5 on a payphone from whatever number you started with. For example, if 714-3432 came in on the pager, by jumping the 5, it becomes 396-7678, the real number that's supposed to be called. And even if this specific example wasn't based in real life, which it very well could have been, the inspiration behind this type of surveillance dodging certainly was. It was largely inspired by another Baltimore drug dealer named Lamont Farmer, who teamed up with Melvin Williams in 1979, streamlining both of them to prominence. But it was Farmer who masterminded an intricate communication system using pagers and punch code sequences on payphones as a means of counteracting police surveillance methods, allowing him and Melvin Williams to duck cases while taking over Baltimore's West Side projects. Farmer also likely served as another inspiration for Stringer Bell. The final character I want to talk about from season 1 is Clay Davis, the conniving Baltimore senator who was funded by the Barksdales and ended up playing Stringer Bell later in the show, who's based on Larry Young, who served as a member of the Maryland Senate from 1988 to 1998, representing Baltimore City District 39 and later District 44, before being expelled in 1998 for using his position to profit from private businesses, who sat as a chairman of the Health Subcommittee of the Senate Finance Committee, was also president of a private, for-profit health consulting firm called the LY Group. The Ethics Committee found that Young uses position and influence to leverage 10 to 100,000 into the group. In addition, the committee found that Young solicited and accepted a number of gifts in violation of the ethics law, including a $25,000 1995 blue Lincoln Town Car. It was later even acquitted of criminal bribery charges. However, as we move along, we come to season 2, which really doesn't have any real-world connections, except for some general themes. The biggest of which, in my opinion, is the death of the working class in America, reminiscent of the climate faced by those affected by the economic collapse that happened in inner cities in the late 1960s and early 70s. And the transition from an industrial to post-industrial society. While the Greek and his organization represent a higher echelon of organized crime than the Barksdales, more equivalent to that of a 1970s Cosa Nostra or a guy like Semyon Mogilevich, which accurately shows not only the landscape of organized crime as a whole, the levels within it, and how they have checks and balances going down the chain on each other. It also shows you the role that each level plays in sustaining one another. For example, how Frank Sabaka deals with the Greeks to sustain his union, while the Greeks use him to move their contraband. Or how Prop Joe uses the Greek as a connect, while he used Joe to offload his supply, thus creating a criminal food chain that runs from probably higher than the Greek all the way down to the corner boys. But that's really all I have for season 2, meaning that we can get into the real last heavy season of the show, number 3. And its connections to real life hit off the bat, because it's in this season that we're introduced to Marlo Stanfield, who rises from a street-level crew runner to eventually snatching the bulk of the Baltimore drug trade and replacing Avon Barksdale, who is based on a real-world kingpin named Tamir Stanfield. And while the fictional Stanfield gets his name from both Tamir and his half-brother, Marlo Bates, it was Tamir, 25 years old at the height of his power, who led a drug gang in excess of 50 members that controlled South Baltimore's Westport and West Baltimore's Murphy Homes. A group that, like the Stanfield crew in the show, was extremely violent and even grown so bold as to deny postal workers access to Westport. The gang was responsible for several murders, including that of a state's witness, four of which went down at the 725 George Street high-rise. And since Stanfield went away at 25 for murder, there hasn't been a drug dealer as violent as him to run the streets of Baltimore. And one of the most prominent members of Marlowe's crew in the show would of course be Snoop Pearson, who is not only based on real life, but is also played by the very same person who inspired the character. Felicia Pearson was born on May 18, 1980, in Baltimore, the daughter of two incarcerated drug addicts, and was raised in an East Baltimore foster home. As a teenager, she worked as a drug dealer and gained her now infamous nickname. And by the age of 14, she was convicted of second-degree murder after the shooting of a girl named Okia Toomer, which she claims was in self-defense, and received two consecutive 8-year sentences for the crime. And despite a try at reform, once back on the streets, Pearson soon returned to drug dealing. But her life changed in 2004 after a random meeting in a Baltimore nightclub where she met Michael K. Williams, the actor who plays Omar Little. He was enamored with Pearson and saw the perfect fit for a new character. So he invited her to come to set one day and introduced her to the writers and producers, and after subsequent auditions, she was offered the now infamous role. And crazy enough, just 3 years after The Wire concluded, on March 10th, 2011, Pearson and 60 others were arrested and charged with drug offenses. The arrest was made during a pre-dawn raid at her home in Baltimore, following a 5-month DEA investigation. Eventually pleading guilty to the resulting charges, she received a 7-year suspended sentence with credit for time served and was given 3 years of supervised probation. Another major character that pops up in season 3 is the former Barksdale hit guy turned reformed boxing coach, Dennis Cuddy Wise, based on a man by the same name. A prominent drug dealer who is also described as one of the two most infamous contract killers in Baltimore, along with Vernon Collins. They both similarly frustrated police by the fact that no witnesses could be found to testify against either man. Regardless, Wise was eventually sentenced to life in prison in 1979 for a contract killing, but this wouldn't stop his run as a player. Upon his conviction, he was sent to the Maryland House of Correction, nicknamed The Cut, which is where Wise got his nickname. The prison he would run through a 19-member elected body called the Inmates Advisory Committee that forwarded inmate grievances to prison management and were granted unbridled access to the prison. Cuddy and a small group of friends, with a penchant for violence, tapped inmates in each of the prison's 19 quote-unquote districts to run for the IAC. And after he ran the campaigns for them, threatening violence against non-supporters, all 19 won by a landslide. Now, with his IAC henchmen granted access to unmonitored parts of the prison, Wise began to smuggle drugs in, and using the prison's numerous payphones, even conducted drug business on the outside. The profit from the outside was used to recruit a handful of correction officers, and soon, they were smuggling for him as well. Four female officers even worked as prostitutes, charging inmates $75 a session, which occurred in empty classrooms that the IAC had access to. Wise also ran a bank that provided high-interest cash loans to inmates. According to corrections officials, prison management at the time was aware of much of this, but refused to act, believing that Cuddy kept the prison population in line. And as a result of his unbridled power in the cut, Wise was transferred to a prison outside Flagstaff, Arizona, in March 1999. 32 other members of his gang were also transferred out of the House of Corrections, while two corrections majors, three captains, nine lieutenants, and 18 officers, thought to be in league with Wise, were transferred or fired. In the aftermath, the IAC was disbanded, and Wise attempted to reform, eventually being released in 2017. But not only did a bunch of new characters pop up on the streets in Season 3, it would also introduce us to a buzzing political scene, setting the stage for the election in Season 4. And one of the most prominent of these politicians is the later fictional mayor of Baltimore, Tommy Carchetti, who's based on a real-life figure named Martin O'Malley. Born in 1963, O'Malley started his political career as a city councilman in Baltimore during the late 1990s. In 1993, Baltimore had over 350 homicides, a record-breaking year for the city, and the annual total would stay at over 300 for most of the remaining decade. O'Malley had an intimate view of the crisis for two terms in the city council, and in 1999, like Carchetti, ran for mayor on a zero-tolerance, anti-crime platform. And despite being a white candidate in a predominantly black city, he completed an upset against primary opponent and fellow city council member Carl Stokes, winning the mayorship with a clear mandate to carry out his anti-crime policies. And he would end up serving two terms as mayor of Baltimore while introducing an innovative GIS crime mapping tool called CityStat before turning his eyes to the governor's seat, eventually winning the spot in 2007 with 53% of the vote, which he would end up holding until 2015. But while his political exploits closely mimic Carchetti's, it was really the policies that Carchetti enacts in The Wire that most closely resemble O'Malley. Like Carchetti, O'Malley's zero-tolerance policy on crime involved a massive increase in stop-and-frisk searches and discretionary arrests for quality-of-life crimes like loitering and disturbing the peace in an effort to clear the corners. And like in The Wire, the result was a massive increase in the quantity of arrests, but a corresponding decline in quality, leading to poor policing practices, fracturing relations with the community, and massive civil rights violations. Now, for the final real-life inspiration that I wanted to touch on today is the story of Hamsterdam, the notorious free zone for drug dealing and usage that Major Colvin sets up to consolidate the district's crime into one uninhabited stretch. An open-air drug market where police never step foot and crime exists unimpeded. And while there has never been a real police-led de facto drug legalization experiment, or at least no such situation has ever been made public, Kurt Schmoke, mayor of Baltimore from 1988 to 1999, entertain the idea of fighting the drug war in Baltimore by decriminalizing narcotics. More than that, however, there are and have been open-air drug markets unofficially sanctioned by law enforcement that are eerily reminiscent of the fictional Hamsterdam, the most infamous of which is probably North Philly's Kensington Avenue, commonly referred to as the largest open-air drug market on the entire East Coast. Crack, meth, heroin, PCP, and fentanyl run rampant in a neighborhood full of decrepit two-story row houses and many abandoned commercial spaces, defunct factories, and vacant lots. Dealers stand out in the open, offering free samples as police stand by and watch. Drug activity isn't hidden there, especially not when heroin can go for as cheap as $5 a bag. The heart of Kensington, McPherson Square, has even become known as Needle Park. And if you want a real-life comparison for Hamsterdam and Baltimore, you need look no further than to the immediate east of the Johns Hopkins Medical Campus in East Baltimore. Another open-air drug market full of drug dealing, dice games, and people flashing wads of cash. And the police seem to have conceded this area to the Corner Boys, who are fighting it out for control of territory. By the midpoint of 2020 alone, there had already been 11 shooting deaths in a fairly compact area. And it's not a unique concept, as there are tons of other open-air drug markets, like the Tenderloin in San Francisco, Washington Heights in New York, and 10th Avenue in Paterson, New Jersey. But that's really all I have for you guys today. I hope you all thoroughly enjoyed today's show, and tune back in next week for episode 54. If you enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating and follow the show's Instagram and Twitter pages at The Black Hand Pod. And please feel free to reach out with feedback, suggestions, and comments. Also, please consider giving a little bit to the show's Venmo at The Black Hand Pod as well. But with that said, I hope you all have a great rest of your day. This is your host, Bliss Grieve, signing out.